Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, Universal hits out at AI-generated music. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we're going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when the full schedule went live for this year's CMU conference sessions at The Great Escape. That's the big story of last week.
It was indeed. We should, I suppose, reluctantly concede the entire Great Escape schedule went live. But of course, what everyone is most interested in is the CMU sessions that sit at the heart of the Great Escape conference. But if you download yourself a copy of the official Great Escape app, all of the showcases and the music is in there now. All the bands had been announced already, pretty much. But obviously, once
Barely,
the...
I'm going to do that now.
Do that.
I'm going to do that. Well, you talk. I'm doing it right now.
Get it downloaded.
Carry on.
And let's hope that you doing a download on your phone next to your mic doesn't create any sort of interference. Does it? Could it? Might it?
No.
Anyway, the point is that in the Great Escape
I'm downloading
app,
it.
You can schedule all the gigs and shows you're going to see. So they're all there. What stages are happening when, who's playing what stage, etc., etc. So you can organise your festival experience if you are going to the Great Escape, the New Talent Showcase Festival taking place in Brighton next month. And of course, there is the conference side for the industry delegates. The conference programme has the partner programme within it. So lots of the Great Escape's industry partners present panels and parties and networking events. So there's lots of discussions and workshops and networking. But regular listeners of Setlist, you will surely know this. At the heart of the Great Escape Conference are the CMU sessions, which take place in the main room at the main conference venue. So the conference hub, if you like, for delegates is a hotel on the waterfront. It's called Leonardo Royal Waterfront, although those of you who've attended Great Escape last year or were the last in-person edition pre-pandemic, it's the same hotel, it just has a new name. So it's down on the waterfront. And in the main room in that hotel, we present the CMU sessions. We think we've already talked about this year's themes, because remember, with the CMU sessions, we pick three themes and we present a day of conversations and talks and presentations and interviews and case studies around each of those themes. So this year, on Wednesday, the 10th of May, Music and Education is our theme, building bridges between those people who educate in music, whether that is teaching the performance and production and composition of music, but also people who are teaching music business and the more entrepreneurial side of being a music maker. Building bridges between those people and the industry, looking at the music education plan that the UK government announced for England last year, how online learning is now a key part of how people learn to make and release and distribute and produce music, and a little bit about what skills people need to work in the business. That's day one. On Wednesday the 10th of May. Day two is music and deals. We'll be looking at all the deals that artists do these days in order to grow their businesses and access investment and marketing and other infrastructure. The many options that artists have, which is brilliant, that artists, when they're doing their business partnerships, beyond the label deal, the publishing deal, working with promoters, there are other options now, which is brilliant. But lots of people still work with labels and publishers and more traditional promoters, and there are reasons why you might do that. We'll be delving into all of that. Plus, in the afternoon, digital deals and a little bit on syncs and samples and interpolations. And then on the Friday, it is the creator economy. So we'll be looking at the wider creator economy beyond music, but crucially, music's role in that and what music people, artists and the music industry can learn from the online creators on YouTube and Instagram and TikTok, etc. Plus, we'll be looking at the online communities that are making music and sharing and developing, you know, beats and stems and samples and things like that. So those are our three core strands. On the Saturday, it's the Elevate sessions, also presented by CMU, aimed at those early on in their music career, supported by Arts Council England. But I guess Andy's key point. Have you got the app installed? Have you got it? Is it on there now?
I'm hoping everything you've said is right, because I've not been listening to you. I've been enjoying this great app.
Everything I've said has been 100% correct. But the key point, the development this week is, if you install the app on your device of choice, then all of the CMU sessions, the Elevate sessions, the partner program, and all of the festival showcases, they are all in there now. So you can go and browse the program and put together your own personal schedule. I will be there. Andy Malt will be there. The wider CMU team will be there. And we've got a really, really, really good lineup of people joining us on stage this year. I haven't even mentioned the keynote conversations. Maybe we'll plug those on next week's set list. Got to hold some greater
space. That's for another day.
Plugging back, haven't I? Otherwise, we're going to talk about in the intro next week. So maybe we'll come back to the keynotes next week. Because, and, you know, we've been away, haven't we, for a while? I mean, we haven't because we had the special edition last week. But the standard format has been away for a while. So it's quite a while since I've been able to say our little cliched line, which is that none of this is what we're here to talk about this week on Setlist.
No, later on, we'll be discussing the big boom in cassette sales in the UK. But first, Universal Music has again called on the streaming platforms to play their part in ensuring that generative AI tools are not infringing the copyrights of the music industry. Although previously they were asking those streaming services not to let AI platforms scrape the music stored in their servers in order to train its software, this time it stresses that this campaign against AI also involves removing music created by copyright infringing AI technologies.
Yeah, so in the 2 months where the standard edition of Setlist was not being published, actually it wasn't quite 2 months, 6 weeks, whatever. The point is, as we discussed at the end of the special edition that we recorded at Wide Days last week, everyone's gone generative AI crazy in the music industry, and lots of tracks are emerging that are going viral and everyone's talking about, which is using generative AI. And I guess the tracks that are going viral and everyone's talking about are where people have used generative AI tools, so AI tools that can compose and create music by basically crunching data linked to existing music. And the ones that are getting all the attention are where people are creating tracks in the style of existing artists, and crucially, with vocals that sound, or in theory, sound like the existing artists. Those tracks are now popping up with increased frequency. As they do, they go viral. Meanwhile, back on the music industry side, some of the copyright questions, which we did talk about on last week's special edition, are becoming more urgent, I guess, in the context of what is happening online with all these tracks popping up. One of the first tracks of this style to get a lot of attention recently was when David Guetta basically used one AI tool to create an Eminem-style track, and then another AI tool to then record the track in the style of Eminem, and then he didn't actually release that track, but he talked about it on social media. But in the last week, it seems to be mainly fake Drake tracks that are getting everyone's attention.
Yes, so a little over a week now, Drake responded to a track that had appeared online, which was made to sound like he had recorded a version of Ice Spice's track Munch. And he commented on that on Instagram, saying, "This is the final straw." It's not clear if he was joking or not. I think he probably was. But yeah, he had some involvement in getting Ice Spice well known and out into the wider world by supporting her on his Sirius XM show. And then there was a whole thing about, had they fallen out or not? It was one of those, oh, he unfollowed her on Instagram things. But then we're not getting into those stories. People unfollowing people on social media is not interesting. Anyway, there's this track and Drake commented on it. And Drake commenting on things gets in the press. And so there was a lot of news around it. Although Universal's subsequent response to fake Drake was not actually related to that track, but another one that emerged a few days later.
Yeah, the fake Drake track that was sufficiently buzzy slash viral slash talked about slash controversial to get Universal Music to put out a statement was a track that was posted initially to TikTok, but then I think, crucially, it started popping up on all the streaming services as well. And it was by somebody who goes by the name as Ghostwriter. I think in the video on TikTok, he had a sheet on his head. Am I right in saying that? Is that what I watched? I can't remember. And it was a track called Heart on My Sleeve, and it had vocals in the style of Drake and vocals in the style of The Weeknd. And Ghostwriter basically admitted that he'd had an AI tool crunch a load of Drake tracks and presumably Weeknd tracks in order to put together the song and the vocals on the track that then got released. And Universal were not happy with that, and they went to the streaming services, and, well, we assume that they demanded that the streaming services remove the track. We say that because the track was not streaming for very long. It popped up on all the streaming services, and then one by one it disappeared. And, as we say, it prompted them to basically put out a statement. And various music industry statements about generative AI in the last couple of months, including a previous one from Universal that we'll mention in a moment. And I guess what all of the music industry statements on AI are trying to do is, well, nobody wants the music industry to be accused of being Luddites again like they were 20 years ago when digital was first taking off. So generally, the statements are, we see the positives, we see the potential, we're very excited about how AI is going to invigorate the music-making process and how artists will be able to use this technology. It's great, we are pro-tech, we are of the future. But, and then then the copyright gripes come.
Yes, so this latest statement from Universal said, UMG's success has been in part due to embracing new technology and putting it to work for our artists, as we have been doing with our own innovation around AI for some time already. With that said, however, the training of generative AI using our artist music, which represents both a breach of our agreements and a violation of copyright law, as well as the availability of infringing content created with generative AI. This is such a long sentence.
Do you think they got ChatGPT to do it? No,
ChatGPT. Because it would have been better then.
Exactly, they would have put some punctuation in.
As well as the availability of infringing content created with generative AI on the streaming services, begs the question as to which side of history all stakeholders in the music ecosystem want to be on. What are those two sides? They are the side of the artists, fans, and human creative expression, or the side of deep fakes, fraud, and denying artists their due compensation. These instances, they go on, demonstrate why platforms have a fundamental legal and ethical responsibility to prevent the use of their services in ways that harm artists. We're encouraged by the engagement of our platform partners on these issues, as they recognise they need to be part of the solution.
So as we did discuss on our special edition last week, there are various copyright questions thrown up by AI technologies, generative AI that can compose and produce and record music. These technologies are not really new, but everyone's talking about them now, partly because the technology is leaping and getting ever more sophisticated. Although I'm right in saying you weren't that impressed with the Weeknd vocals on this fake track.
It was rubbish. I think that's the problem with all these things. I think it should be the reason to take it down was because it was just shit.
But
it was not a good track, and the vocals were very unconvincing.
Despite
so, there you go, that's
Andy Malt not being convinced, but let's remember, it takes a lot to convince Andy Malt. Despite Andy Malt not being convinced, the technology is getting ever more sophisticated. Plus, of course, there have been a few platforms, ChatGPT. Do you know what I discovered when I was doing a presentation the other day? It's quite hard not to say ChatGBT. There's some phonetical things going on there. But you have to say it really slowly.
I thought you were going to say ChatGTP.
PT. Anyway, obviously, that got a lot of hype. There are some equivalent platforms that do images and music that have also got quite a lot of hype in recent months. So that is why, although this technology is not new, although the copyright questions linked to this technology are not new, everyone is talking about it again. And it feels like those copyright questions, well, we need to answer those questions with a degree of urgency. There are two big copyright questions around music making AI. The first is, if an AI technology creates a piece of music, is that piece of music protected by copyright? Or are we assuming that In order for copyright to exist in a piece of work, it has to be a human-created piece of work. UK copyright law does actually say that if a piece of content is created by a machine, it actually talks about computer-generated works, because it's, you know, copyright law in the UK hasn't been updated that recently. But it does actually say that if you have computer-generated works, then whoever created the technology that created the work owns the copyright, which suggests that UK copyright law is recognizing that machine-created content could be protected by copyright. In the US, however, the US Copyright Office has said that, although US copyright law is not explicit on this, because you have to register to get full protection under US copyright law, and you do that with the Copyright Office, and the US Copyright Office has said that works that are entirely created by AI do not have copyright protection, but works which are AI assisted do. And of course, that then throws up a whole load of other questions about, well, what does that mean? Where do we draw the line between a piece of content being entirely created by AI versus AI assisted? But I guess it's the other copyright question that is super relevant here, which is, in order to train an AI technology, you have to expose it to a load of data linked to existing songs and recordings. It crunches that data, or mines that data, if you prefer. And if an AI technology is accessing all of that data and working with all that data linked to copyright-protected music, can it do that without having a license from whoever owns the copyright in the music? Now, the music industry is very clear on this. No, it cannot. A license is required. But not everybody in the legal profession thinks it's quite that clear. Some people would argue the law's a little bit ambiguous on this. Certainly in some countries. Maybe under US law, it's very clear. Maybe under UK law, it's very clear. The fact that the government here was considering putting a specific exception into law for data mining, it's not really anymore, but at one point it was, would suggest that the government thinks that there isn't currently an exception. But even if in some countries, clearly you do need a license in order to do some data mining, maybe in some countries you don't. And then you get the question of, well, what if you were to crunch that data without license in a country where you can, without getting permission from the copyright owner, but then you were to release the music globally? So lots of complicated questions to be asked. And I guess the point here was, I mean, you referenced that Universal Music sent a letter to the streaming services a few weeks ago that then got picked up by the Financial Times, where what they were saying to the streaming services in the first instance was, we know there are AI technologies out there that are crunching data, accessing music in order to train their technologies without license. They may well be scraping music off the streaming services in order to do that. And hey, streaming services, you need to make sure that can't happen by putting some sort of, you know, rights management technology in place to stop people scraping music, because, you know, we all know that the music industry has a long history of successfully employing digital rights management to stop the infringing of their rights. That technology never really works, does it? But anyway, they were basically saying to the streaming services, you need to make sure people aren't scraping music off your platforms in order to train their technologies. And then, as we say, with this new letter, they were then taking it one step further and basically saying, if an AI technology has grabbed some music from somewhere and trained itself without license, and then music has popped out the other end, you should make sure that that music is not available on your streaming services, and the makers of that music are not able to earn via your streaming services because the track was created with copyright infringing activity. And I guess with this Ghostwriter track, he basically admitted that he'd crunched a load of Drake tracks without license. So from a record label's perspective, from Universal's perspective, he admitted to infringing copyright. And it was on that basis that they demanded this track be removed. And that's what they were saying in this letter. Because I guess in the absence of the admission of data mining without license, you could sort of get into, well, does Universal Music have the right to demand these tracks be removed? Because they don't own the copyright in the track. Obviously, if you're training the AI to do cover versions, well, that's different because whoever owns the copyright in the original song could get it removed. But where it's an original piece of music, well, the label doesn't have any copyright interest in that music, which then pushes into the territory of, well, are there other grounds on which Universal Music and or Drake could get the content removed? Could Drake say, well, that technology ripped off my voice And as a result of that, you should remove the track. Well, there's no copyright in a voice or a vocal style. Maybe you could protect that in some countries under a thing called publicity rights. There's actually a really interesting case in the California courts at the moment where Rick Astley is trying to protect his vocal style through this concept of publicity rights. That's not an AI case. They just hired somebody to sing in his style. But I think what you're probably getting from this very long, slightly tangential journey I've gone on, there's quite a lot of complicated questions. And although with quite a lot of those questions, Universal Music and the music industry at large are coming out and saying there are clear rules here and we all need to obey them. And hey, Spotify and Apple and Amazon, you need to obey them too. I think most lawyers, except those who work for Universal Music, etc., would say there's quite a lot of ambiguity here. We don't really know the answer to most of these questions.
Yeah, and although, like you say, this technology has been around for years, it's still very early days, and it's really starting to now gain traction in the public consciousness. And so we don't really know how ultimately it's going to be used, because I think this trend for taking a track and, you know, putting another artist's voice on it, whether that's a cover or a new piece of music, it's the novelty. We're in the novelty stage at the moment, and that's not ultimately how it's going to be used for the most part.
Yeah, so it could be one of those scenarios where we all invest weeks and weeks of our lives agonizing over these legal questions, and it turns out that once the novelty of the gimmick's over, no one's interested in this music anyway, and it all just sort of goes away. So, yeah, interesting legal questions, but also how is this technology realistically going to be used, and to what extent? We all recognize the opportunities, obviously, but to what extent is it a genuine threat? And, yeah, as you say, too soon to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately it will be like anything. I mean, we're both old. We've lived through a lot of things that are going to be the downfall of everything, and then they end up not being. And I think this will ultimately just be another creative tool that is part of the creative tools used by people. There was an interesting thing Tony said last week on the Wide Days episode about people are still going to want to be fans of people. So I think there's always going to have to be a person involved. It's interesting to hear Drake's voice artificially put onto some other track, but when you know that's not actually Drake, you know, it doesn't help you be more of a fan of Drake. Not that you should be a fan of Drake anyway, he's rubbish, but there's my opinion on Drake coming out again. Yeah, like, who wants to hear fake Drake long term? No one, I don't think. So it's going to be another thing where we talk about it for ages and it comes to nothing. That's what I think of AI. It's going to be one of those, and it's going to get tedious talking about it. But it's fun at the moment. Now's fun.
Yeah, I was in a meeting a couple of weeks ago with a bunch of artists who were talking about all of these issues that have suddenly become big news stories. And one of those artists, it was a sort of meeting where people were saying stuff in confidence. So I can't tell you who it was, but it was an artist who was had quite a lot of success back in the 1980s. And he was talking about how in the early 80s...
David Bowie?
the ghost of Bowie was at this meeting? No, but it was an artist who had success in the 80s. And he was talking about all the stick he got in the early 80s by parts of the music community for using a drum machine at his shows. So,
yeah.
Yes, technologies.
I worked with a band who used a drum machine in the 90s and they got sticks.
Yes, we've had technology that put all the drummers out of work, but I'm sure Andy would agree. Who wants drummers? I should add that Andy drums. That's the context to that statement. Please, drummers, don't send in complaints. But yes, I think. There's probably
unlimitedmedia.co.uk.
There's probably more positives than negatives here, although the copyright questions and the commercial questions are nevertheless interesting. But I think what you're basically saying is, when it comes to how the music community deals with the rise of generative AI, you just want everyone to be a little bit more Liam Gallagher. Is that what you're saying?
That is what I'm saying, because we talked about Drake and his response to hearing himself voicing another artist's track. And, well, I mean, Drake, being one of the biggest artists in the world for some reason, has had this done to him quite a lot. So he's heard himself voicing other people's tracks a lot and appearing on tracks that he didn't actually record. This happened to Liam Gallagher this week. There was a whole album released, supposedly of tracks recorded but never released by Oasis in the late 90s. It was, I mean, that's just sort of the start. I don't think anyone actually pretended that. It was actually the work of a musician called Bobby Geraghty, using tracks recorded by his former band Breezer, who sound quite late 90s Oasis in their style. So he took music that they'd recorded in about 2021. He trained some AI technology on Liam Gallagher's voice, and then he replaced his own vocals on the tracks with those of Liam Gallagher so that it would sound like these lost Oasis songs, and he's put them up on YouTube. And that's a very creative use of AI, and does actually sound quite convincing, aside from the fact that Liam Gallagher's vocals sound quite often like his mouth is full of wool. But I mean, who's to say that Oasis wouldn't have gone through a woolen mouth period in their creativity? People do weird things, don't they? So maybe that's a thing. But anyway, Liam Gallagher commented on this. He said he hadn't heard the whole album, but he had heard one track, and he said it was mad as fuck. Not in that voice. I'm not going to mimic his voice. He said it was mad as fuck and said that he sounds mega. He also said that what he'd heard was better than all the other snizzle out there. I think by that, he just means all music. He might just mean AI-generated music, but I think he's just saying it's better than everything, which, I mean, that's the sort of thing Liam Gallagher would do, wouldn't it? So it sounds like me, so it must be better than everything.
Yeah, so Liam Gallagher seemingly quite positive about the AI version of his voice singing these songs. I guess if you're not willing to do a Liam Gallagher impression when quoting him on Setlist, presumably there's now an AI tool we could use to have you...
Maybe I'll do that, yeah.
To get those words spoken as if by Liam Gallagher. Maybe we could get in touch with Bobby and see if he could run it through whichever AI tool he was using. Anyway, Liam Gallagher is sold on the AI revolution, we think, based on these two tweets.
Yeah.
Drake less so. Universal Music, definitely not. Who knows where this is going next? My prediction is there's going to be quite a lot more of us banging on about this on Setlist in the next few months until everyone gets bored of it and we forget about it and we all start talking about something else. That's a prediction for you. We'll see if it comes true.
And finally, on this edition of Setlist, the cassette revival continues unabated. It's rolling away. The numbers are growing and growing. Cassettes are back, everyone. It's 2023, and cassettes are the biggest, not the biggest, not even really big. Cassettes are one of the formats that people are buying music on. And yeah, it's 2023. The BPI put out some stats about cassettes. That's what we're talking about.
We are indeed. They're not even really new stats, because some of these were actually snuck into the wider report the BPI put out at the start of the year about the consumption of music in 2022. But the BPI has a new little guide out called All About the Music that aggregates all of their stats from last year. So they're sort of pushing out some of the headline stats again to get a little bit of notice for that guide. And they went last week with the cassette revival because in 2022, 195,000 cassettes were sold in the UK, which, and this is the important bit, is 5.2% more than in 2021, and the highest number of tapes to be have sold in a 12-month period since 2003, when the best-selling cassettes were various editions of Now That's What I Call Music. So cassettes are back. I mean, obviously, last year, consumers in the UK did buy 5.5 million vinyl records and 11.6 million CDs, plus the vast majority of the money that the record industry made last year came from streaming, not physical. So actually, if you were to put the cassette stats next to all of that, it would be a blip on the page so small you wouldn't even notice it, which is probably why we didn't notice it when they first published it late last year. But thanks to a press release, we are now aware that more cassettes were sold last year than the previous year.
They're catching up. They'll be there soon. It's only a lot before it catches up with vinyl. But, you know, vinyl had a revival. I think cassettes within 5 years will be selling numbers in the many millions.
I met someone a few weeks ago, a young person, because I occasionally meet young people, because, you know, I go and lecture at colleges. And it was a young person who was embracing the cassette revival, had bought a few cassettes, particularly off like Bandcamp, I think, where a lot of these cassettes get sold, isn't it? And he'd even found himself a Walkman. I don't know what, I didn't ask whether it was a new Walkman. Do they make new Walkmans, or had he bought it off eBay? I don't know. I'm pretty sure in my parents' garage, I've got a box of about 17, not Walkmans, because I never actually bought a Sony Walkman. I used to buy really, really cheap rip-off Walkmans that always broke.
This is why you've got a box.
Exactly. <Yeah. laughs> They only ever worked for about 2 months. But anyway, he was embracing the cassette revival. And I did say, as somebody who grew up during the cassette era, that's sort of when I was, you know, buying lots of albums first as a teenager, was during the cassette era. As somebody who grew up in that era, there is absolutely no reason why you would want to embrace that format, because obviously with vinyl, lots of people argue actually in terms of sound, vinyl on a decent record player with decent speakers, you're hard to beat that. There is nothing about a cassette that makes the music sound good. They are, you know, cumbersome to use. You can't skip tracks. I guess the one thing you can say about a cassette is it does force you to listen to albums in the order that they have been put together by the artist, because skipping tracks is such a nightmare. They break. They are... No, why would we want a cassette revival? Unless... And we did mention this in our report on this in the See Me Daily last week. There is some anecdotal research to suggest that at least a chunk of the vinyl revival, not all of it, but a chunk of it, is people who buy vinyl records not because they want to play them. They don't even own a record player. They just like something about the physical product. Some people put them on the wall as a piece of art. And I guess if people are buying a vinyl record as a piece of merch, well, it's a lot cheaper to produce a cassette than a vinyl record. So if physical recorded music products are becoming merchandise, why not sell them a cassette? But please, for actually listening to music, I just can't think of any reason why you would pick cassette.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, that's sort of interesting. You met someone who was actually listening to cassettes. Although that said, I just inherited a car that has a cassette player in it. So I've been trying to find my cassettes before I rip that thing out and replace it with something more modern. Anyway, we joked about cassettes, or I joked about it anyway, you know, cassettes catching up with the vinyl revival, which is clearly ridiculous. Although the BPI did say in its statement on all this that the format is playing a significant role in the sales mix of some brand new album releases. On 10 occasions last year, the format accounted for over 10% of the chart sales of the number one album on the weekly official albums chart, which seems just... What? And it goes on, some of these chart-topping albums sold more copies on cassette than on vinyl when they debuted at number one, including Florence and Machine's Dance Fever and 5SOS5 by 5 Seconds of Summer. So maybe cassettes will catch up with vinyl. Maybe that's something that's going to happen, and it shouldn't. It just shouldn't.
Of course, that's partly because, as it currently stands in the UK, physical sales still have more power when it comes to the way charts are calculated, certainly the albums chart, which is why quite a lot of labels, well, most artists and labels these days don't care about the chart, but for those artists and labels that do, it is worth doing some physical release around the actual release date and then pushing it out through retail, but also maybe direct to fan. And if you have a fan base which are vinyl consumers, making sure you get a vinyl release out. But I guess maybe for certain fan bases, as I say, cassettes can be a lot cheaper than vinyl, and it can help with your chart position, which is as much to do with the way the charts are being calculated in the UK as anything else. But yeah, the BPI did manage, despite the fact that the stats, despite the growth, are super low, of demonstrating how it can have a tangible impact on the launch of a new album and maybe anybody wanting to game the system. That's one way that they could do it.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that, I mean, sometimes when I talk to people, I mean, particularly people outside the music industry, about cassettes still being bought and sold, what if people will say, but who's really, no one's releasing music on cassette now, are they? I mean, sometimes people say that to me about vinyl, but well, they certainly did a few years ago. But it's interesting that it's not just, I mean, I always think of cassette releases as sort of a niche indie thing, but actually there's a lot more mainstream artists who are releasing albums on cassette. And as the BPI says, it's helping them go to number one. And so we should run through the best-selling cassettes releases of 2022, I think. I mean, we're going to. Whether we should, that's another matter. But so the number one...
We don't normally do charts on set lists, do we?
Let's go reverse order like it's Top of the Pops. In at number 10, it's Machine Gun Kelly with Mainstream Sellout. Number 9, The 1975, Being Funny in a Foreign Language. Number 8, Blackpink, Born Pink. 7, 5 Seconds of Summer, 5 SOS 5. Number 6, Robbie Williams, 25, XXV. There's a lot of numbers here. 5, Central C, 23. 4, the numbers are confusing the chart. In at number 4, it's Muse with Will of the People. Number 3, Florence and the Machine, Dance Fever. Who's at 2? It's Harry Styles. He's got Harry's... It's Harry's house. Harry Styles, Harry's house. And number 1, what do you have next to your house? It's The Car by Arctic Monkeys.
So there you go, the top 10 best-selling cassette releases in 2022, and you introducing a chart element to set list is making me think, actually,
like,
if the industry really wants to get sort of the retro feel of the cassette era of the music industry out there, whenever you buy one of these cassettes, really you should have half of Bruno Brooks introducing the track before it plays. Because obviously the thing most people remember from the cassette era is illegally taping music off the radio and having to quickly pause before the DJ's voice came on, so you never quite got the first 5 or last 10 seconds of the track.
Yes, because then obviously otherwise, if you were making AI-generated tracks in the 80s, you would train it on those tracks and then the voice would sound like a mix of Boy George and Bruno Brooks.
So
there's a joke for the kids.
Mark Goodyear, who else presented a chart show? David Jensen.
I don't think that helps.
Let's name check all the people who presented.
Let's just say names of people that kids don't know.
But anyway, cassette revival is a thing. It's not really, but you know, it's enough of a thing that we managed to fill 10 minutes of our podcast on this. Hey, do you think there's any mileage for there to be a cassette release of Setlist? Maybe not on a weekly basis, but maybe from our archives, we could pick out one of our particularly special editions and see if anyone out there would buy it on cassette, because they're quite cheap to produce. So as a merch idea, it's probably more realistic than anything else we've ever thought of.
No Such Thing as a Fish did an episode on vinyl, so I don't think it's out of the question.
Yeah, vinyl's quite expensive.
Maybe we could just put this section on cassette.
This is something which we might look into. So if you're listening and you think that that might be something that you would spend British money, doesn't have to be British actually, but not Bitcoin, it would have to be proper old-fashioned cash, then maybe we'll look into that. That's something that we haven't done merch for Setlist, have we? We really ought to think of something.
No.
Maybe this is it. Maybe this is how we can actually generate some revenue from this bloody podcast.
Yeah. Anyway, my doorbell's just gone, so let's stop waffling on.
Yeah. Let's wrap it up.
That's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. If you want to read more about anything we've discussed here, go to the show notes where you will find links to everything we've talked about this week. Don't forget to subscribe to the show, rate and review the show, and if you've got any complaints to make about Chris's comments on drummers, email them to setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook, and for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.